Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and today my guest is Sir Stephen Wall, author of Reluctant European, Britain and the European Union from 1945 to Brexit. This was published in September by Oxford University Press. Stephen is no ordinary biographer of Britain's 47-year membership of the EU, which ended in January this year. First, he is the official historian of this relationship, as designated by the Cabinet Office, and has so far published three volumes reaching up to 1985. Second, he actually lived much of this political history from the inside. Starting in the diplomatic service in 1968, he joined the press team in Downing Street in 1974, assisted two foreign secretaries in the Callaghan and Thatcher governments, and headed the European Community Department in the Foreign Office from 1983 to 88. And that's just the appetizer, because from 88 to 91, he was private secretary to three foreign secretaries, then did the same job for John Major when he was prime minister in 91 to 93. Then for 5 years from 95 to 2000, he was Britain's permanent representative to the European Union in Brussels, before returning to London to serve as head of the Cabinet Office European Secretariat under Tony Blair until 2004. He's done plenty since then, but we can return to some of that later in the discussion. Stephen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
As I said, you have written three volumes of the official history and you still have 35 years to cover. I think I can guess, but what made you decide to jump to the end and publish Reluctant European this year?
Well, two things really. First of all, it's not clear that the official history series, in a recognizable form anyway, is going to continue. I was at the tail end because when the cuts came in, in 2010, the then cabinet secretary decided to axe the program as was. So they honored existing contracts. And what will happen for the future isn't clear. And anyway, that, as you say, I was in writing those volumes, I was working for the government and I was telling the story based on the archives. And basically, I wanted to tell the story as I saw it. Hopefully in a way that is objective, but I did want to begin and end the book with my own personal views, which of course I couldn't do if it was still an official work.
Oh, I see. Okay. What struck me, I mentioned it was a 47-year membership, but what really struck me reading it, particularly in the first few chapters, was how compressed the timeline feels, the sheer speed of events. For example, from getting the go-ahead to join the EEC to joining in 73 to arguing about the budget to Thatcher, which I didn't know, by the way, considering leaving in 1980 over the budget. And we'd only been in for 7 years. Did it feel that way to you at the time? And did it feel that way to you when you were writing it?
Well, I suppose I'd lived all of that. And I think As you rightly say, we joined in 1973. We would, of course, have joined 10 years earlier had it not been for the two vetoes exercised by President de Gaulle of France. And I think that 10 years of being kept out already kind of created a kind of sense of tension between Britain and our future partners. And then because we joined late, we had to join on rather unsatisfactory terms. The Labour government that came into power in 74 renegotiated those terms and held a referendum where 66% of the electorate voted to remain. And I had thought, as I think most people did, that that would be the end of it, that we might grumble, but basically we were in it for the long haul. But the budgetary issue, the question of Britain basically paying more into the common budget than she should have done in terms of our relative prosperity, that had not really been resolved by the Labour renegotiation. And Margaret Thatcher took up the cudgels. I mean, had Jim Callaghan won the election in 79, he would have done the same, albeit not quite with such ferocity as her. And although I don't think she ever thought seriously then about leaving the European community, she certainly did think about withholding Britain's budget contribution, which in a sort of precursor a bit of some of the argument we've been hearing here in Britain recently, would have been an illegal act. I mean, the government would have had to legislate to make it legitimate to withhold the budget contribution, and it would still have been illegal in European community law. And the then Attorney General, Michael Havers, father of the actor Nigel Havers, did say that the government had to ask itself the question whether to do that would have either credibility or respectability. And she backed off.
Yeah. Early in the book, you identify some of the sort of original sins that eventually led to Brexit, going right back to the referendum and the Civil War and the development of a worldview that you call English virtues against corrupt continental and alien popery. In his review of the book, Andrew Rawnsley said, quote, "Stephen Wall is not an inevitabilist, but his account will give a lot of ammunition to those who are." Do you agree with him?
Yes, to the extent that, I mean, I think this is always a problem, isn't it? Because whatever happens or has happened, we always look at the things that made it possible to happen or even likely to happen. I mean, we look at what happened after the First World War and we attribute the seeds of the Second World War to the Treaty of Versailles, rightly. But I mean, the fact is, you know, without the monstrous genius of Hitler, would World War II have happened? I mean, I think the basic thing that I think the book shows is that there was never really a period of our membership where we as a country were at ease with it. We didn't really like the whole concept that we had to accept as the terms of membership, that this was a project whose members were committed. Britain was formally committed to political union and economic and monetary union. And we always kind of disliked that in a way that our partners didn't. And some of the time we pretended to ourselves that it wasn't going to happen. And at other times we fought against it. So with relatively rare exceptions, there wasn't a time when popular support for the project went very much above 50%. It hovered around the 50% mark most of the time. An exception to that was obviously the 75 referendum. And another exception was when Margaret Thatcher, basically, it was her initiative, the single European Act brought in the single market in goods and services inside what was then the European community. And Lord Young, David Young, who was then the Secretary of State for Trade, had an advertising campaign to bring to the attention of British business this new single market. And public awareness over the three-month period of this TV campaign went up from 3% to over 90%. And the popularity of the European community went up as well to around 65%. And I think that's about the highest it had been. It certainly never, I think, got to those heights ever again.
I remember those well. It's funny because what you say there, and it's certainly the theme of the book, this sort of tragedy of misunderstandings and political mistakes and that half-hearted feeling towards the European Union. I'm not sure we're unique in that. I mean, if you look at the you look at how the French voted in the first round of the 2017 presidential election, you're looking at 40 to 45% of people voting for candidates who either wanted to leave the EU or leave the euro area. You look at the way Italians voted in 2018. I was being struck that there's actually very few countries that have a sort of it's rather in their DNA, the Germans being one, maybe the Spanish, obviously the Belgians, but not many more really have it deeply embedded in them, this sort of mission towards European Union.
Well, I think public opinion in the rest of the EU did change over time. I think that if you look at the history, you have the original Treaty of Rome, the founding treaty in 1957. And then apart from treaties of accession, i.e. the treaties which individual countries like us signed in order to join, there's no significant further treaty change until 1985, and you get the Single European Act setting up the single market. Thereafter, there are quite a lot of different treaties. Obviously, the Maastricht Treaty, which introduced the single currency, and then the Amsterdam Treaty and the Nice Treaty and the Lisbon Treaty. And I think that those treaties were designed by politicians and bureaucrats, and ordinary voters couldn't quite see what's the relevance to us. You know, the exception to that is, of course, the Maastricht Treaty introducing the single currency. And that was, in a sense, rather half-hearted. I mean, they willed the ends in terms of economic and monetary union, but those who signed up to that treaty didn't really will the means. In particular, they turned their face against fiscal transfers, in other words, against transfers of money from the rich countries to the poor countries. And Margaret Thatcher said at the time, you know, if this is going to work, it's got to be like a nation state in which the wealthier regions provide support for the poorer regions. But that can only happen in a true political union. And for her, that political union was a step too far. And in a sense, the Eurozone has been kind of wrestling with that dilemma ever since. I mean, I think now, and the latest measures that they took just a few weeks ago, they are moving closer towards a fiscal union. And I think that's, you know, that is obviously one of the issues that was at stake when David Cameron decided to call a referendum. And I think that, looking back, the Maastricht Treaty was a very significant parting of the ways when we opted out from the single currency. I didn't see it at the time. I mean, I thought it was obviously significant, but I didn't realize how significant, in that it would set most of the rest of the EU on a path which politically and economically was very divergent from the one we stayed on.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It didn't have to be, though, did it? I mean, if you look at, they weren't in at the time, but the Danes were, but the Swedes weren't. So there are a number of established rich democracies that have given no indication of joining the euro in the near future, but are quite bound in with other common policies and that don't have this sort of semi-detached position. It wasn't inevitable that we ended up where we did, don't you think?
No, absolutely not. But I think that, you know, there was always an additional tension, if you like, between us and the other two of the largest member states, France and Germany. And there too, we paid a price for joining late. I mean, the rules of the club were obviously established primarily in the interests of France and Germany. Part of the whole purpose of the coal and steel community and then the European community was reconciliation between France and Germany. France had, after all, been overrun by Germany three times in less than a century. And there was, therefore, in the economic way the project was constructed, there was a benefit for Germany, which would she would have access to a single market over time for her burgeoning industry. France would get massive support for her agriculture, which remained in the 50s and through the 60s an important part of the economy, and in particular important politically. I mean, President Pompidou, when he negotiated with Heath to let Britain into the European community following the death of de Gaulle, Pompidou said, "You know, I don't want all these conservative peasants who vote for me to turn into urban industrial car workers voting for the socialists or the communists." And we were not part of that. And we wanted to be part of a sort of troika, if you like, running the show. But one of the things about the relationship between France and Germany is they did make real sacrifices to each other in terms of their national interests. We always found that very, very difficult. We weren't good at the kind of rhetoric. The French were very good at the rhetoric of European Union, even if they occasionally had their fingers crossed behind their backs. The Germans genuinely believed in that rhetoric because, although very few of us saw it coming, for them, German reunification was always a realistic and a real ambition. And Helmut Kohl, when he was German Chancellor in particular, Kohl's view was, you know, Germany could easily drift into a kind of dangerous neutrality. And therefore, German reunification can only happen safely if Germany is bound into Western political structures. And that structure was for him, a political union. So for him, that was a very real thing. Whereas for us, Margaret Thatcher was the supreme exemplar of it. For her, the answer was, you have tough nation states and you stand up to Germany.
Mm. Yeah, I thought that was a very interesting point in the book you made about Kohl and the speech he made in 1984, where he talked about the United States of Europe. And Geoffrey Howe at the time tried to harness him into a broader relationship that included the United States and so on, and Thatcher was antagonistic. But it made more sense to me because my memory of it at the time was that Kohl was afraid of German power, and that always struck me as rather anachronistic. But fear of becoming an enormous Switzerland, that seems a much more realistic fear. And Germany has come close to it a few times.
And I mean, the French sort of veered between the two. I mean, they were worried either that Germany would drift into neutrality or that it would be the dominant power again in Europe, with all, you know, the fears that provoked. And President Mitterrand's reaction to that was, the answer is to clasp Germany tightly to your bosom, as it were. And he did a deal with Kohl whereby Kohl accepted the notion of a single currency, giving up the Deutschmark. And that, on that basis, Mitterrand was prepared to accept reunification. I mean, his instinctive personal reaction to German reunification was as hostile as Margaret Thatcher's, but unlike her, he didn't translate it into overt hostility.
Yeah, I mean, in your experience working for various foreign secretaries and prime ministers, did you, and you mentioned that Blair attempted this idea of trying to prise apart Schroeder and Chirac, did you ever have an experience with any of them where you felt they were making a really sustained diplomatic effort to crack in there rather than it just being on a whim and then they're giving up?
Well, I think if you take the Thatcher period, there's no doubt in my mind that Geoffrey Howe was determined to make that effort, tried to make that effort. But you know, the relationship between, I mean, they were chalk and cheese as personalities. I mean, Jeffrey Howe, who was a lovely man. I really enjoyed working for him. And he essentially believed in the power of reasoned argument. And that wasn't her way. I mean, not that she was not capable of reasoned argument, she was, but I mean, she had very, very firm views, and those views prevailed. And so the distance between them widened to the point where eventually, as you know, she sacked him. I mean, John Major, I think John Major is probably epitomizes in a way a certain kind of pro-European view in Britain, which was not wanting political or monetary union, but wanting to make a success of our membership. We were one of the bigger countries. We needed to get on with France and Germany. And his first speech as Prime Minister in Germany talked about putting Britain at the heart of Europe. But it was already immensely controversial within the Conservative Party. Part of that was because once he had signed up to the Maastricht Treaty, and Margaret Thatcher was then sitting on the back benches in the House of Lords, she set herself up pretty disgracefully, I think, in very open opposition to what he was doing. And a lot of people, younger members of the Conservative Party, kind of gathered at her feet, and loyalty to the former leader and opposition to Europe became synonymous. So, I mean, when John Major, rather to everybody's surprise, won the general election in 1992, and I was working for him, I can remember saying, well, you know, this is great, you know, you've got your own mandate. And he said, you know, you wait, this is where my troubles begin. I'm standing astride a crack in the Conservative Party that's getting wider by the minute. And of course, it did get wider and wider.
And her repositioning, I always did find a little strange. And there's this nice little anecdote you mention in the book where you printed off the Bruges speech for Tony Blair, and he read it and came back to you, and he said that, you know, that seems entirely reasonable and not extreme. And yet she's been reinvented and reinvented herself as a Eurosceptic, even though she is the person who brought us the Single European Act, which you could argue is the basis of today's European Economic Area. She wouldn't have liked the moves towards greater forms of federalism, but actually to leave the single market, if she were being consistent, I don't think she would advocate that.
No, I think she was getting more sceptical as time went on. Although even after she stopped being prime minister, she never kind of denounced the treaty that had given rise to the Single European Act. I mean, she was very much opposed to the single currency, but this is impossible to know. But I think it's quite likely that had she remained prime minister, she would have been persuaded by the same argument that John Major was persuaded by, which was that if we didn't allow our partners to go ahead, those who wanted to with the single currency, they would have made a separate treaty outside the European community, European Union. And we would then have been completely excluded from any influence over it, let alone the possibility of joining it. And one of the things, I mean, we now all think about the opt-out as being because we didn't want to take part. At the time, haunted a bit by what had happened with the Treaty of Rome, in other words, we paid a price for joining late, as big a concern as staying out was to ensure that if there came a time when, for economic reasons, we wanted to join, we wouldn't pay a price for doing so. So I think it quite likely that she, if she'd stayed prime minister, would have come to that same conclusion. But she wasn't prime minister, and so of course she was free to say, you know, over my dead body, I would never have allowed this.
Well, and it's what happened to Cameron in 2011 with the fiscal compact. You differentiate each time you go through a prime minister, each chapter where you discuss a prime minister, you break them down between instinctive Europeans and sort of transactional Europeans. And from memory, I think you were basically saying the only instinctive ones were Heath and Blair, and the others were transactional. Do you feel that was there a missed opportunity? Was there a missed prime minister who could have avoided the situation we've been in now, do you think?
Well, Heath actually is quite an interesting example because, I mean, he was an instinctive European, partly based on his wartime experience. Although, as Prime Minister, when there was an opportunity, and he almost seized it to make a partnership with Germany in what was later to become the exchange rate mechanism and the forerunner of the single currency, in the end, he declined to do so. And the documents I was looking at when I was doing the official histories show that he was pretty skeptical about the European Commission and about the European Parliament. I mean, he became much more kind of traditionally European after he'd ceased to be prime minister. So even he was, he was a genuine believer. I mean, towards what turned out to be the end of his prime ministership, i.e. the end of 1973, the first year of our membership, on the back of the Yom Kippur War, when the Arab states imposed an oil embargo on much of the European community, not on France and Britain because of our rather different attitude. Heath was then beginning to realize that Britain needed some recompense for these large sums of money it was paying into the budget, and was looking for money for the poorer regions. And Heath's last act as prime minister was to instruct Alec Douglas-Hume, the foreign secretary, to go to a meeting in Brussels and say, there's no way we're going to come to the rescue of other member states who are suffering because of this oil embargo unless they're prepared to cough up and give us money so that we're not paying so much into the budget. So he was already being forced into that transactional mold, basically.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it was funny for me reading that part because that was watching a British government, and the Labour government did it afterwards too, behaving like Spanish governments did, you know, like González did at the Edinburgh summit, or like the Eastern European governments did, trying to maximise regional transfers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not how I tend to think of British government somehow.
No. And I mean, I think you mentioned Tony Blair. I mean, there's no doubt, you know, that Tony Blair had absolutely no kind of hang-ups about our membership. I mean, for him, it was just a sort of logical and necessary and desirable thing. But again, he partly because he'd never been in government before he became prime minister, but he had no sort of concept really of the power of the European Commission or its role under the treaties, very little regard for the European Parliament, and again, really believed that the show should be run on a kind of intergovernmental basis by France, Germany, and the United Kingdom. Hence this attempt that was briefly made after the Gulf War in 2003 at Chirac's suggestion. I mean, Chirac was completely open in his view that the European Union, with all these new member states from Central Europe, was going to be ungovernable, and therefore Britain, France, and Germany, you know, had to kind of take charge. But it proved unworkable, partly because the French and German relationship was too entrenched for us to break into it, and partly because, again, I mean, Blair was weakened by then by the fallout from Iraq and wasn't in a position to get British ministers to make the compromises that we would have needed to make. And I think this is a feature of our system that, you know, we have a very well organized system, you know, whereby, you know, the whole of Whitehall comes to an agreed view about a particular proposed piece of legislation, and then we tend to stick to it. But it also makes us rather inflexible, and we're not very good at making trade-offs in the way that our partners, certainly the French and Germans, have been good at doing that.
Is that the reason? Because I was struck reading it, and also just from the experience of covering the European Union, that a succession of British governments failed in a sustained diplomatic effort to build a liberal alliance. So, you know, we talked about trying to break into the Franco-German alliance, but trying to build something wider. And the obvious example to me is 2012, when you got the letter from the 12 member states to the European Council president and the creation of the Northern Future Forum. It struck me at the time that there was a potential there for a sustainable alliance of like-minded countries with Britain at the helm, but Cameron didn't follow it up. Is that something that happened often, that just lack of, I mean, again, you talk about it in 88, about when Thatcher agreed to sit at the Law Committee, she put Robin Lee Pemberton in it, assumed the Bundesbank would veto everything, and then just forgot about it. Is that a pattern?
I think it is. I mean, when I was working for Tony Blair, we had a sort of informal alliance with we might call it some Nordic alliance with the Swedes, the Danes, and the Finns, and we used to meet very often. But you know, they were small, obviously much smaller member states than us. There's an extent to which the smaller member states have always been intimidated, really, by the larger member states, and France and Germany in tandem can be, you know, a pretty brutal force. I've watched it in operation. And there's I think a bit I record in the book where you know, Thatcher, when told by the Foreign Office that and I think during the negotiations of the Single European Act, she gets a piece of advice that lots of member states support our position. And she said, how often have I been told that, only to see that melt away, leaving us alone to fight the battles? And I remember being at a meeting where she, you know, we said to her, you know, don't intervene, Prime Minister. Others have the same view. And she came out and said, I said nothing for 10 minutes. And then it was perfectly clear that unless I did speak up, nobody else would. I recall a conversation between John Major and Cavaco Silva, the Portuguese Prime Minister, when Cavaco, I can't remember the issue now, but John Major and Cavaco were absolutely at one. And John Major said, so when we get into the council, you know, I'll speak and will you speak? And Cavaco said, you must be joking. I'm not going to open my mouth on this subject. So.
Well, actually, in that respect, I do wonder what's going to happen to the EU with issues like, for example, tax harmonisation, where many people hid behind the UK positions, and with the UK out, they're going to have to out themselves.
Yeah, but I think this will be interesting to see. I mean, the Irish are obviously a very strong case in point, because obviously it's less relevant than it was. But the sort of German view: why should we go on paying money, the structural fund support for Ireland, when they're undercutting us with sort of zero tax rates for investors? I mean, I think if it's well, I suppose what has changed is that there are more individual countries within the European Union who are now basically saying we're not going to march to the single tune if it doesn't suit us to do so. I mean, that has its own dangers, clearly, for the unity and success of the project long term. But I mean, you know, Poland and Hungary at the moment are kind of extreme examples of that. But one wouldn't have, I don't think we would have seen that in past times in the way that we're seeing it now.
Yeah. You gave the impression towards the end of the book. In fact, you put Brown and Cameron together in the same chapter, this post Blair chapter. That Brown, to some extent, fed some of the anti-European sentiment that developed in the final years, particularly with the way he used to his approach to negotiations. He used to turn up in Brussels and had to turn everything into a fight. Do you feel that he did contribute to the souring of the popular view?
Well, he certainly, during his, he, I mean, yeah. Yes, I do. I mean, not least because, you know, he did have an opportunity to tell the story rather differently. But you know, he certainly, when he was Chancellor, as part of his, you know, campaign to supplant Tony Blair. He was, you know, he was courting the Mail, and he was courting the Murdoch press, and that was, you know, part of the way of doing it was to be seen to be fighting this sort of muscular Britishness, even when it was largely manufactured. And I think, I mean, the book he wrote in 2016, before the referendum, kind of reflects that. It's ostensibly a pro-European book, but it's all actually about Europe as a sort of vehicle for a kind of British national predominance, rather than seeing the thing as a partnership.
Mm. So, I mean, where do you think we will be in 2025, 2030? I mean, I tend to have this suspicion that there is a logic to us essentially ending up inside the EEA or a rebranded EEA. Are you as optimistic as that, or?
Well, I'm with you in terms of the logic of it, because from my personal conviction, I'd love to see us back in the European Union. Except that I think that assuming that public opinion turned in that direction, which is obviously a huge if, going back in, we wouldn't have the budget rebate. We would have to be part of the single currency. So there are big hurdles there, which I think in terms of negotiations and potentially in terms of a referendum on membership would be very huge hurdles. Whereas it seems to me that if you are outside, given the importance of this relationship, both politically and economically, and it's going to continue that way, we're not going to suddenly shift the balance of our trade massively. The EEA and that type of relationship is the best you can get short of actually being part of the club, absolutely. And I think that a future government where hopefully this issue has lost all the poison that it's had in our system would be able to contemplate that, not least because the advantages compared with the second or third rate relationship we seem to be headed for now, the advantages would, I think, be very apparent.
And it does seem to be more perhaps in keeping with where broad British public opinion is, that we, in quotes, we joined a common market, we didn't join a new state.
Yes. I mean, of course, as I say in the book, Ted Heath did sign up publicly to both economic and political union before we joined. And Harold Wilson reaffirmed the commitment during his renegotiation in 74, 75. But no, I agree with you. I think that is the case. And I mean, paradoxically, of course, in a way, it's what de Gaulle was offering us back in the at the end of the 1960s, and rejected rejected by the Labour government on the basis that we would be rule takers and not rule makers.
Mm. Well, since you're not going to be, it looks like you're not going to be writing any more of the official volumes. Are you working on anything else, or planning to work on another book?
I'm not. I think I've probably shot my bolt as regards writing about Europe. It was a cathartic thing to do, and I think other people will tell the story with much greater perspective and not as much of a dog in the fight as I have. But I think it was a story that needs to be told. But I suspect if I return to try to writing history, I'll choose a completely different era, probably.
Well, since this is a podcast about books, I'll finish with a question which is about the power of the written word and not about Europe. And you have said that The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins led to your loss of religious faith, I presume in your 50s or 60s, which is very late. What exactly happened?
Well, I think, possibly like quite a lot of fellow Christians or fellow Catholics. Anyway, I mean, I would love to be a believer. I would love to believe that there is an afterlife and so on. And I think therefore I didn't allow myself to address the alternatives that actually there isn't an afterlife. When I started on Dawkins, I wasn't reading it hoping to be convinced by him. I had no particular expectations, but he kind of forced me, I think, intellectually to think about things in a way that I hadn't thought about before. And I found his arguments convincing in a sense that I could no longer kid myself that I was believing in something that fundamentally I didn't believe in.
Okay, well, today I have been talking to Sir Stephen Wall about his new book, Reluctant European, Britain and the European Union from 1945 to Brexit, published by Oxford University Press. Stephen, thank you very much for joining the podcast.
Thank you.